This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Thanksgiving Day, amid the turkey and the trimmings, the smells alone are enough to transport us to the kitchens of our youth and the tiny tasks we were assigned as part of the preparations. Over the years, we moved up from napkin folding to table setting until we actually became part of the cooking team and absorbed lessons about peeling and mashing, basting and baking, all part of an essential education. Over the course of this hour, we'll talk with several well-known chefs about their education. Mary Sue Milliken, Chris Schlesinger, and Jose Andres have all contributed essays to a new book called How I Learned to Cook. And we want to hear from you this Thanksgiving Day. Tell us a story about how you learned to cook. Who or what inspired you? The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Later, the chef at the restaurant voted best in the world joins us. He's got a new mission, the search for culinary perfection. But we begin in Los Angeles, where Mary Sue Milliken joins us. She's co-chef and co-owner of the Border Grill restaurants in Santa Monica and Las Vegas and Ciudad restaurant in downtown Los Angeles. Welcome and happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving to you, Neil.
Your entree into cooking, your beginning of the fascination with it, as described in your essay, came baking many, many years ago during summer vacation up in Michigan.
Up in northern Michigan, yeah. We, you know, had lazy summers, and the days seemed like they took, forever to pass, and geez, it's the opposite of how it is now. But we, you know, I remember being kind of bored, and I was when I was asked to write about how I learned to cook, it just popped into my mind that one afternoon my cousin and I were looking through my aunt's Red Book or Ladies Home Journal or some, I don't know what magazine, and we came across this wacky recipe, and we got so excited about it, we got on our old clunker bicycles and rode to the grocery store and got all the ingredients.
And this was not for mere dinner rolls or anything like that.
Well, it was called an apricot coffee cake, but the reason it kind of attracted me originally, I was in about fourth grade, so I was like 9 or 10, and I remember reading it and thinking, what on earth? Why would anyone go to this much trouble to do what they're telling you to do? It was an operation that took 8 or 10 hours, and it had to be folded and rolled and rested and refrigerated and warmed. And I thought it seemed so ridiculous to me.
Yeah.
But in the end, we followed it, you know, word for word. And here it was, this light, beautiful coffee cake that rose up, and it was, you know, I realized many years later that this is what Danish dough is, or like puff pastry, where you have layers of butter and dough.
And it came out great.
It did. It came out wonderfully, but, you know, we didn't get to sleep all night. We were waking up and checking the dough, and, you know, it was very exciting. It was really fun. And I'm one of those kind of people that I could have been a surgeon or I could have been a chef. I just love science.
Mm-hmm.
I love the science of cooking. And this was a great, you know, I think just one of those moments when I found something that was really fascinating to me and I did it without having any idea what I was doing. Most people learn how to make a puff pastry or a Danish dough when they, you know, when they're older and they're either in chef school or somewhere, you know, you learn how to make it or you're working in a bakery. But here I was learning how to make it with no idea what I was doing.
I gather you went to schools later to get a formal education.
I did. I graduated from high school in 3 years instead of four because I was so gung-ho to get to chef school. I moved from Michigan to Chicago and went to a trade school on the south side of Chicago called Washburn Trade. And this was in the 70s, so there were 100 students in the chef program and one girl.
And I assume one of the first things they try to teach you in a school like that is that everything you know is wrong.
It's funny. You know, the first thing they try to teach you is, you know, how to keep up with them at the bar across the street.
Well,
that was what I learned from my classmates. From my teachers, they were really good, actually. I think it was so unusual to have any women in the program. That was a little bit baffling for them. But they did, you know, have a curriculum, and we went through. We just went in every morning, and we started cooking. And we cooked, you know, 365 days a year for 2 years, and that's how we learned back then. It's quite a bit different now.
Let's see, get some listeners in on the conversation. Where did you learn to cook? What or who inspired you? Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And Miguel Aron, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, with us from Portland, Oregon. Miguel? Hello? I guess they're not there. Thanks very much anyway. Let's go to Britt. Britt's calling us from Oakland, California.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call and happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
I learned to cook by observing my mother in the kitchen. I went and sat at a desk in our kitchen and usually kept her company. We talked while she prepared dinner. And over the years, I just pursued my own curiosity and eventually got to help. I'm the one of four sons my parents have and was proud to be the first to learn how to properly cut up a chicken. And I haven't looked back. As I'm talking to you, I'm standing over the stove now preparing some food items for a Thanksgiving meal.
What are you making?
Oh, a number of things. A big pot of collard greens and mustard greens with turnips and smoked turkey wings inside, and another dish, a combination of sweet potatoes and yams that's going to turn out really, really good.
Curiosity, Mary Sue Milliken, I think that's a key element of any success in the kitchen.
Oh, absolutely. It's really, it fuels everything. I mean, and the thing I love about this profession, and I've been doing it nearly 30 years, is I keep learning. You know, constantly learning new things that are just so much fun. I read an article in the New York Times a few months ago about how to cook the perfect boiled egg. And it was sort of like that Red Book article where it sounded so wacky. You cook it in, you put it in water, and you put your thermometer in there. You get it to 148 degrees, and you let it hold at that temperature, which is really like a very hot bath. For about 50 minutes.
So considerably below boiling.
Yes. You can put your finger in there, especially me because I have asbestos fingers.
It would have worked for my sister who had a habit of burning them, but...
Yes, but actually it was the most delicious. They're the most delicious eggs. Now that's the only way I cook them.
All right.
I love them. I love them. They're really yummy.
Well, Britt, I don't know if you're going to be cooking your eggs that way. I'm not part of many people's traditional Thanksgiving dinners, but have good luck with your dishes and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much, and the same to you as well. Happy
Bye-bye.
Thanksgiving.
Let's go now to, this is Judith. Judith with us from Stevenson in Washington.
Hi.
Hi.
I have to tell you about my favorite cook. My inspiration was a lady by the name of Sedanka Colescott, who showed me the art of cooking and the passion of food by showing me how to pluck duck in her kitchen after school in our neighborhood in Northwest Portland.
Plucking was not the acme, the top spot in that cooking process, was
right,
it?
Right, exactly. And other kids in our neighborhood that I grew up with still today talk about how we all were sat down to pluck duck and tell Sedanka about our day as she gave us ginger ale.
And once the duck was plucked, what happened to it then?
Well, you know, as a child, I can't remember because the exciting part was plucking the dead duck because for us, being urbanite children, we had never seen dead duck before. And so she really did teach us the passion of gourmet cooking from the age 8 onward. And today, being a mother of 3 children, I'm hoping that I'm passing that same tradition on to my children.
And Mary Sue Milliken, no matter where you learn it and no matter who you teach it from, passing it on is a critical element of the whole art, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I'm so curious about what she could have possibly done with those ducks after she got all those grade schoolers to help her pluck them.
Yeah, I remember really fun gourmet dinner parties at her house as a child, and it was in the 70s, and they allowed us kids to run around and be part of that adult party and conversation. And growing up in Northwest Portland in the 70s, there were a lot of artists. So I remember there being just a lot of artists talking and mingling, and they were drinking good wine before it was the height of being chic like it is today.
Well, it's really important, I think, to have your kids be part of the whole program, you know, when you're enjoying food. And I've been doing that with my two boys, too. They're very adventurous eaters. I'm very lucky. They really, you know, enjoy eating all kinds of things, you know, from, you know, innards and outards and all kinds of really exciting food.
I wish, you could only wish, I had a daughter who thought that baked potatoes were too spicy.
Well, yeah, I believe kids are born with a palate, you know, and you really can't change it one way or the other. You got to try to guide it and nurture it. But, you know, we have friends who really can't tolerate strong flavors. But, you know, I try to just work around them and make them the nicest bland food I can.
Judy,
I think it's important to introduce strong-tasting cheeses to the kids when they're really young, because once they have that taste of kind of the rich foods, then you can introduce a lot more flavors as they grow older.
Yeah, the less for them, the more for us.
Right. Well, that's true. More cheese for us, huh?
It sounds as if, Judith, just listening to the background, you have a couple of kids running around learning lessons today.
Yeah, they've been working on spinach gratin, and before that they had been making shortbread cookies, and yesterday they were helping me with pumpkin pies.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to them and to you. We appreciate the phone call.
And thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you and your family and your friends.
Okay, Judith. Thanks very much for the call. And Mary Sue Milliken, what are you up to later today?
Oh, geez, well, I've got a turkey in the oven, and I'm going to do a pork shoulder roast. And I got 25 people coming over at 3 o'clock. So I've got a lot going on.
We wish we could be there. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Same to you, Neil.
Mary Sue Milliken is the co-chef and co-owner of the Border Grill restaurants in Santa Monica and Las Vegas and Ciudad Restaurant in downtown Los Angeles. She called us today from her home in Los Angeles. When we come back from a short break, Chris Schlesinger tells us how he went from dishwasher to chef and how not to barbecue a wild boar. And we'll take more of your calls. How did you learn to cook? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Thanksgiving tends to make many of us, sometimes planned but often out of necessity, chef for a day, even if we can't tell a yam from a yucca. Today we're talking with some of the country's best chefs about how they learned to cook. Their stories are compiled in a new book called How I Learned to Cook, and you can read the essays from our three guests today at npr.org/talk. And, of course, you're invited to join the conversation. How did you learn to cook? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Joining us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Chris Schlesinger. He's the owner of the East Coast Grill in Cambridge, and it's nice to have you on the program. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you too, Neil.
Now, as I understand it, you were torn early in life between becoming a chef, becoming a cook, and being a surfer.
Well, I used the conflict to my advantage a little bit. We did a little bit of each and, you know, trained how to be a chef and then traveled around to some warm weather countries, wasting a lot of time, and actually served as an inspiration for some of my later food.
Mm-hmm. But at one point, you were on your way down to the beach and your sister said, hey, they just fired all the cooks at the restaurant down the street.
Well, that was my first. I had just dropped out of college and I was at our house in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and they came over and asked me, did I want to go cook? And I said I didn't, but my grandmother said, yes, I did, because she felt that I needed a job.
Yes, grandmothers are funny that way.
And I went in, and it wasn't cooking, it was washing dishes. And then guy says, go grab a beer and get over there and wash all those dishes. And I did a good job, and at the end of the night, he offered me the permanent dishwashing position.
So. And the rest is history. But along the way, you stopped at the famous Culinary Institute of America, which I've always heard described as the real CIA.
That's right. Well, my father was interested in me having some sort of formal education, and I had moved up from dishwasher to cook at the Blue Pete's in Pungo, Virginia. It was a large volume seafood house. And so he had collected a lot of information on the CIA, which was kind of inferring that you could go there and come out and be a French chef and make $25,000 a year. So he thought that was a good idea. And I went and graduated in 1977.
Where it sounds as if you learned a job, but where you learned a profession, where you learned a career, where you learned to be excited about this, was another restaurant you worked at in Boston called Harvest.
The Harvest, yeah. That was back in late 70s, early 80s, and there was a bunch of us there at the same time. People have gone on to open their own restaurants, Jim Burke, Bob Kincaid at Kincaid's in D.C., Frank McClellan up here, and it was a time where it was like we're just a bunch of young kids really trying to do interesting food. The owner was Ben Thompson, the architect, and his charge to us was he wanted to have really avant-garde food. So I think it was some of the worst food ever prepared and some of the best. But
Give us some examples of both, and we teased people by saying we'd learn how not to roast boar.
Well, we would go to, he sent the chef, Jim Burke, to France for a couple months, and Jim came back with a bunch of contacts, and we would call France and order vegetables. And back then, you know, the baby vegetables were very new. Kiwis were the rage. And so we would go to the airport and pick up the vegetables and bring them back and spread them out on the back table. And, you know, we found ourselves going to the library to do research to find out how to use these things.
Nevertheless, one of the lessons of roasting, of spitting and cooking a boar is to keep that spit moving.
Well, that's right. We used to do cookouts out on the patio there, and it was one of my jobs to get out there and do different things. And we had a West German boar, and unfortunately the boar, the spit stopped spinning, and the boar caught on fire in front of all the diners. So that was one of the biggest.
It's all part of the presentation. It's all,
right,
part of the all part of the show. Let's see if we can get a listener on the line. This is Ben. Ben with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes. Hello, Neil. How
Hi.
You doing?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. Oh, I actually learned how to cook from my grandmother. She had told me one day that she didn't want me to have to rely on a woman. And I thought, oh, okay, oh, yeah. And then years later, I realized that it wasn't really me she was training. She was training me to where no woman would have to deal with me relying on her.
She was working on behalf of her sex, in other words.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. I guess that's sort of a union stance, I guess, in a lot of women who teach men to cook, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an email we got from Bruce in Jeffersonville, Indiana. I learned to cook watching my grandmother around the kitchen table. She made everything from scratch, and it was quite educational. Then in college, I learned that being able to cook was a great way to impress the girls. We would invite them over for chicken cordon bleu, and the rest is history. Did that work for you, Ben?
A couple times, yeah. I was warned by some of the men in my life that if I did that while we were dating, that it would be expected the rest of my life. And here I am. My wife is at work, and I'm fixing the turkey.
And you're fixing the turkey today.
Yes,
well, that's,
sir.
You know, I wonder, Chris Slayson, on a day like this, are you fixing the turkey?
No, I'm not. My job was to bring the wine and the shrimp cocktail, so we kind of rotate around with a group of friends. So
a simple task.
Yeah.
Okay. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And here's another email. This is from Robert in Driggs, Idaho. When I was in high school, I used to cut classes to watch the cooking shows on PBS in New York. Julia Child and the Master Chefs were my inspiration to follow a culinary career. Did you ever watch those, Chris?
No, not really. I mean, we were in the kitchens, and I ended up, you know, when I was doing my work back in the 70s and 80s, it was funny. The kitchens were mostly older men, and, you know, it was more about cooking 20 prime ribs and 250 steaks and some duck a l'orange and things like that. It wasn't until later that people seemed to get a little bit more interested in food.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be great shrimp cocktail today.
I hope so.
Chris, thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
Have a nice Thanksgiving.
Chris Schlesinger is owner of the East Coast Grill and spoke to us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. His essay from How I Learned to Cook is also available for you to read at npr.org. Our next guest is Jose Andres. He's the chef and owner of several restaurants here in Washington, D.C. They include the tapas restaurants Haleo and Cafe Atlantico. Jose Andres has been kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. Welcome. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much. Hi, Neil.
And your story, I was fascinated because it was a lesson in learning small and learning how to build up. You learned to cook, right from your father, who would every once in a while, about every other week, cook a giant thing called a paella. Tell us what was in that, first of all.
Well, paella is kind of the most undiscovered dishes probably in Spain. It's this amazing rice dish where many ingredients can be invited, mm-hmm. from rabbit to chicken to different kinds of seafood and vegetables. But the truth is that my father loved to cook that paella for many people. And for many years, he will only let me help him with the fire.
Mm.
We will make this amazing fire using the vines from the previous harvest.
And you weren't running out for bags of charcoal.
We'll go for charcoal and make the fire. And he'll put me in charge of the fire. It'll be a very critical moment where all of a sudden you have to get a big fire during 5 minutes, and all of a sudden you have to take all the charcoal underneath, mm-hmm. because the paella doesn't need more fire, and if not, we'll overcook. So to me, the first time, the second, the tenth time was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But one moment I'm like, Daddy, why you don't let me throw the chicken in? Why I cannot be part of this process of cooking? No answer. You keep doing what I'm telling you to do. One day I got very upset, very upset. My father told me, go home, I'll talk to you later. He told me 1-2 hours later, my son, the task I've been giving you for all these years actually is the most important task. If you control the fire, you'll be able to control cooking. So he was right. Controlling the fire, mm-hmm. give you everything you need to one day become a cook.
But you said you did not believe him that day.
I didn't believe him that day. I kind of went by home saying, yeah, right, but
yeah,
he's
sure.
not letting me put the spoon inside the paella pan. And I learned the lesson probably through the years. Through the years, when you are teaching someone else, when you are controlling the oven temperature, when you are controlling the oil, just by watching how kind of the surface of the hot oil kind of moves, and you kind of know what temperature is only by that. That's the moments that you kind of look back in time, and you remember when you were younger, and your father was kind of giving you a lesson that sometimes, because we are young, we are not able to understand.
And being a chef of these days, of course, is being as much an administrator as being a cook. And to be an administrator of a place like that, you have to know every job.
Well, you have to, but I try not to. And the team is everything in the restaurant industry. And I have very good people in many areas. What I try to do is just be thinking about mm-hmm. the cooking process, the creative process, that to me is one of the most fascinating moments, not mm-hmm. the creation process when you're cooking.
Now, today, do you still make paella for your family?
Oh, yeah, for family. And I believe that if in 10, 20, 30 years from now, every single backyard in America in a Weber grill is going to be making a Sunday paella. Everything is started right here in Washington, D.C., on the D.C. side in Chevy Chase. A lot of people make paella around my neighborhood by now, believe me.
Let's see if we can get some callers on the line. And this is Eileen. Eileen calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Like many people, my mother taught me how to cook, and she was a great Southern cooker. I remember helping with the liver and onions and the pork chops. But then around the time that I graduated from college, I started to live a vegan lifestyle and, you know, not eat meat, not eat any sort of animal byproducts. And so in subsequent years, I found myself teaching my mom how to prepare tofu, make nut cheeses. So it was this really neat kind of flip-flop.
So you were teaching the teacher?
Yeah, exactly.
And how did she take to it?
She was a bit skeptical at first, but I'd like to consider myself a good cook, so I think I won her over.
Uh-huh. And what are you preparing today?
Well, certainly not turkey, but we have some good stuff going on. We have a green bean casserole, some potato cake things, a baked tofu. One thing I like to do is take Martha Stewart and veganize her recipes. So we're doing a lot of that today.
Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving.
And same to you.
I wonder, Jose Andres, when you first came to this country and looked at the Thanksgiving traditions, what did you make of it?
Well, at the very beginning, I will tell you, you saw that was some kind of, you know, a parade. The streets were empty.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first year, probably, back in 1991, 1992. And it's funny because Thanksgiving, you can call it whatever. You can call it Christmas. You can call it whatever holidays you want to celebrate. At the end, is this moment that you see that people are uniting themselves around a table, sharing a moment, cooking. And I don't know, when I participated in one of the first ones was in Queens with the Arias family, mm-hmm. one a family of Spaniards that they came to the States many, many years before. And year after year, kind of I had a Thanksgiving with different families in different parts of America, the Kanjis, the Lombrosos mm-hmm. in San Diego, in La Jolla. So it's funny because to me now, for many years, I have certain Thanksgivings that they have a name, the name of the family I share with.
I see.
And this is a nice memory that keeps you kind of in check with your recent past. And I think it's a good way to see it.
Here's an email we got from Jeff in California. I've always cooked, but always from a cookbook. Now in my late 50s, I've begun to improvise and even invent recipes. I think it has to do with memory loss. Like many in late middle age, I'm finding it harder to remember names, dates, facts, appointments, you name it. But my theory is that somehow this has enhanced my creativity. Less emphasis on data has led to more space for invention. All right, I see a skeptical look from our chef over there.
No, this is unbelievable. I'm very happy to hear a person saying this because it was a great man that in the early, late 80s said, Jacques Maximin, one of the best chefs in the history mm-hmm. of Europe, that says, to create is not to copy. That's creativity. And so if this man is able to throw his cookbooks garbage and all of the sudden he's creating, please, can you call me, contact me in Washington, D.C.? I am in need of people like you because it's not an easy thing to talk to the ingredients and make sure the ingredients talk back to you and you are able to understand them.
Our guest is Jose Andres. We're talking about how you learn to cook, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Elaine on the line. Elaine is with us on the road in North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, Elaine. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, okay. My mother was a home demonstration agent, graduate of the University of Georgia, and so she taught me not only to cook, but she was teaching me chemistry in the kitchen as well, so that I was learning super saturated solutions and Brownian movement and various other things as she taught me to cook.
And did this actually come in handy later in school?
Well, actually, since we were farmers, it came in handy from the time I was very small, like 8 years old, because I was cooking full meals for the workmen that we hired seasonally when we were baling hay or when we were putting up silage.
So these lessons came in handy right from the beginning and applied physics, if you will.
Absolutely. Of course, yeah. I was in 4-H, and then I would put my cornbread and various other things like that and my pickled and canned items in the fair and win my blue ribbons.
Now, you're on the road in North Carolina, so are you on the way to Christmas, to Thanksgiving dinner?
Yes. I'm headed to my brother's, and my niece and her husband and children have already arrived there. They called me a while ago to see what time to expect me.
Well, so if they're listening to the radio, you're on your way.
Yes, I'm on my way. I'm not that far since I am approaching Asheville now, and then I have to go from there down to Brevard.
Well, you drive carefully, and have a happy Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, thank you so very much.
Appreciate the phone call.
May I add one other thing?
Please go ahead.
From farm cooking, which was basic, like meatloaf and roast and things like that, I learned my experimentation and the true joy of cooking from Julia Child when mm-hmm. she first started her program in black and white on public TV. And then the other book, that just became and remains my constant companion is Joy of Cooking.
Well, thank you, Elaine. And again, have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you so very much. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
I thought the meals always looked better in black and white. I don't know about you.
Well, I love to be kind of collecting some of the early cooking shows that mm-hmm. were in America or in Europe. So I'm happy she's mentioning this because I've only been able to see a couple of the original ones of Julia Child. Mm-hmm. But I think it's something very interesting about the experimentation because today is this kind of chefs. You're going to have Heston Blumenthal very soon.
Yes.
Where I do a mini bar that we are doing what is called modern avant-garde cooking, and I think it's a lot of experimenting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to see that people in the streets that they cook in their homes, they feel they are using science and chemistry to understand better the process of everything we do. Because actually, ladies and gentlemen, cooking, it's experimentation through chemistry and science help us precisely to understand the Maillard reaction. Everyone today has Maillard reaction in their homes. Why? Because the Maillard reaction is the browning of the meat, the browning of the skin. So every single person has Maillard reaction happening in their ovens right now, and they don't even know it. So they should buy Harold McGee and understand what Maillard reaction is.
Thanks very much for being with us, Jose Andres. Appreciate it, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to all. Thank you.
Jose Andres is chief and owner of several Washington restaurants, including Haleo and Cafe Atlantico. He joined us here in Studio 3A. As he mentioned, when we come back from a short break, Heston Blumenthal, the chef whose restaurant was voted best in the world last year. This is the Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.